Rocket Talk. I am Justin Landon, the host of the program, and I apologize for the lack of Rocket Talks this holiday season. Scheduling is a bit of a challenge at this time of the year, and there's not as much happening kind of in the field through the holidays. Although, truth be told, I went through a deep depressive state after closing my blog, Stapper's Book Review, and I needed some time. Unfortunately for me, a depressive state means I've become obsessed with golf, which is kind of strange, but I've been spending a lot of time on the golf course, so I apologize for the lack of Rocket Talks. Anyway, I'm very excited about this week's show. I'm joined by two people who I enjoy an embarrassing amount, Mallory O'Meara and Jason Utz. Is it Utz or Utz?
I say Utz, but a lot of people say Utz. That's the way they pronounce the potato chip company.
I was going to say, it's like the potato chips.
That's awesome. It is. Sadly, I'm not close enough to actually get any of that money.
You're not part of the Utz empire?
No, I'm a black sheep.
But you can do so many great pickup lines.
It's because we say Utz instead of Utz. That's why.
The voice you hear is Mallory. She is the communications director at Dark Dunes Production. They're a horror film company who is producing films like Harbinger Down, Kids vs. Monsters, and Yamasong. They have produced Lord of Tears, which you can buy now. Hi, Mal.
Hi. This is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart.
Yes.
So I'm very excited to be on here tonight.
It's going to be great. And the gentleman that you heard is the aforementioned Jason Utz, who was no way connected to the pretzel empire. He works in IT by day, and by night, he is a dungeon master with like 30 years of experience. And he's an incredibly charming fellow. Welcome, sir.
You are too kind. It is a pleasure to be here.
So these are two names, Mallory and Jason, that maybe some of the listeners here are not familiar with, unless you're big fans of Mike Cole and Cameron Hurley, and you follow those two writers on Twitter, in which case you probably...
I was just going to say, it's all on Twitter.
You probably know a lot about Mal and Jason, but if you don't... Mal is the significant other of fantasy author Mike Cole, and Jason is the significant other of fantasy science fiction writer person Cameron Hurley.
Speculative fiction author.
Yeah, Cameron Hurley. I am fascinated by the idea. We always hear about writers and what a miserable, crazy existence they lead in their little word shacks where they sit and peck away, and that they're lonely and alone, and this is not reality, right? Like, they have people in their lives.
It's bullshit.
Right,
we swear?
You could swear all you want.
Oh, thank God. Yeah, total bullshit.
I mean, we do have a fuck limit, and I don't know what it is, but they're, you know, it's like a PG-13. We could probably only do it like 10 times, but other than that, please.
We can get it. Do we want to get it over with now and just avoid the word for the rest?
No. You never know when you're going to need
it. You never know when you're going to need it. That's right. That's right.
Science fiction swears. Are those okay?
The science fictional swears, yeah. You can frack as much as you like.
Frack and drek and.
Yeah.
And smeg and.
So anyway, I've invited Jason and Mal on the show tonight because I want to know what it's like.
Anyway.
I want to know what it's like being the significant other of a writer who is constantly under deadline and constantly living this crazy life that we always hear about. So I kind of want to start with you, Jason. We always hear that writing is a solo and lonely endeavor. I mean, how do you respond to statements like that as somebody who's there in the trenches with Cameron like every day?
It's absolutely true. Everything that you've heard is absolutely true. Short show. I mean, there's certainly a lot of solo time that has to go into writing just because of the time necessary to put words on electronic paper or whatnot. I mean, just like anything else, you know, you have to feed into it. So you have to do a lot of stuff to get your ideas and everything like that. So. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of life that goes on outside of the countless hours spent locked in a tiny room or whatnot writing.
So, what's your perspective, Mal? Are you insulted by this notion that the writer's there on his own without any support whatsoever?
I'm not insulted. I really think that anybody who is in any way connected to the professional writing industry, whether it be any genre, is very, very well aware of the fact that not only does the actual process of writing a novel require a whole team of people. I mean, I beta read for Mike. I help like edit, we're constantly talking about his books, but also writing is, in this day and age, for most writers, a very social activity. You're on social media all the time. All of Mike and I's vacation, or most of Mike and I's vacations are conventions all over the world. There's a writer community that you have to get involved with, and there's fans that you have to be involved with. So it's not as if Mike lives on the top of a tower and, you know, I put food in a bucket and raise it up to him. Like it can be a very, very social lifestyle.
I love this idea of Mike in a tower being fed by bucket.
I was going to say bucket, but that's the go-to is really the bucket on a rope is, yeah.
I was putting, you know, tying it to a pigeon, but the pigeons were becoming increasingly unreliable. So I switched the bucket.
The problem is Jason Cameron has a treadmill desk. And so it's really a moving target with the bucket on a rope.
It's true, yeah.
That's kind of awesome.
Plus, the problem with the birds, of course, is that, you know, a lot of times they can't lift too much, so you have to get a couple of them on a line.
Right.
Yeah. Well, unless they're an African swallow.
Well, yeah, an African swallow, maybe.
Then you can extend
but
a whole coconut.
But not a European swallow, that's my point.
In case anybody doubted, Mal and Jason's geek cred.
No, yeah, seriously, throwing down the gauntlet. But no, I think anyone who thinks that writing is by default a lonely thing is very, very out of touch with being a professional writer. I mean, I completely agree with Jason that there's a lot of time where Mike spends by himself writing, or by himself as much as you can get in our studio apartment, which means he's got his headphones on and I've got my headphones on. But we are very, very, I mean, we're basically attached at the hip. I wouldn't say that Mike is lonely at all when he writes.
Mal, you just mentioned this notion that most of your vacations are to conventions, and that's just kind of part of the business. And I laugh because Jason and Cameron at the last – I don't remember what convention y'all were going to. It may have been Confusion. But you made Cameron stop at all kinds of different spots along the way.
We do the same thing. I do that.
It wasn't Confusion.
Convergence.
Convergence. Because it was in Minnesota. So you have to go to the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota because it's in Minnesota and it's only like an hour away from the con. So yeah, I love road trips. So I love these roadside attractions. So we stopped at the Spam Museum. And we stopped at we went to the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota, and which is the truth. And where else did we? We went to some sort of gumbo shack that was like we were like, oh, we're kind of hungry, and we, you know, used the power of the pocket computer that we all carry to find places nearby. And I'm like, this place sounds weird. And we went there, and it was supremely weird. It was a very good food, extremely good food, but the owner, is there like most of the time, and he like slides into your booth and cozies up to you and starts talking to you
weird, like
uncomfortably creepily close and like puts his arm around you and like starts giving you life advice. We
Are you
got
sure
lucky.
It was a restaurant.
It was a restaurant. It really was.
Some guy's house.
You know, it wasn't huge, but it was a restaurant, and we got lucky. But the couple behind us, they were a new couple, and he talked to them for like 20 or 30 minutes. I swear, trying to give them advice on, you know, their relationship advice, and dodged a bullet.
This sounds like Cameron's wheelhouse. I mean, this sounds like Cameron's favorite place on earth.
She was pleased about the experience because it was just so surreal. She was like, I don't even know that really just happened when we left. She's like, it just, no one will believe this. Because yeah, he just gets up. He's like, "Hi, how's it going? And how's the food? You know, I made that."
So so Jason and Cameron's convention travel took them to the ball of twine and to this bizarre restaurant. Now, Mal, you were lucky enough that you and Mike decided to go to Worldcon this year, so you went to London. Which, as far as convention side travel goes,
I mean, it's no ball of twine, but London is pretty cool.
It is.
We go. Mike and I probably go to a con. We travel somewhere for a con every month or month and a half, depending on my travel schedule for work. And what we do is we'll go to the con for the weekend, and we'll either add a day before or a day after that we can go sightsee, or we'll go to a B&B for a night, just so we kind of have a little us time, a little vacation time. Like, we went to London. It was my birthday. So we took one day off the con and went and did my Mallory birthday things. And so I never feel like, oh, all our vacation time is spent at writing conventions. Ugh. Like, we have a lot of fun.
Yeah. And that's obviously a unique part about being in a relationship with a writer. I think particularly in science fiction and fantasy, like, this is probably not true if you have a relationship with, like, Malcolm Gladwell or Jonathan Ferris or something. But like with a science fiction and fantasy writer, particularly a mid-list science fiction fantasy writer, somebody who is not, you know, hitting number one just because they put a book out, like, conventions are a huge part of it, but it's also an enormous time investment.
Yes, it is. Time and money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like I said, that's why we use it as, like, instead of going to a week, spending a week just somewhere as a vacation, we get little bits of vacation for cons because they're a tax write-off. So it's sort of like getting a free vacation.
Yeah, and I have to imagine, Jason, that for you and Mallory both, like, it's a huge advantage that you're both into it, kind of. I mean, you're
oh,
both.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, you're both geeks, right?
Yeah.
Like, so,
oh, yeah.
Nerd love. I mean, Mike and I are from different parts of the nerd world. Like, I am sorry to blow my cover, but I do like a lot of science fiction and fantasy, but horror and monster stuff really is where my nerd flag sits. So Mike and I, it's like we live in the same city in different neighborhoods, but we generally have the same nerd language and we like a lot of the same stuff.
Hey, what about, is that same true for you and Cameron, Jason, or is it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I enjoy all facets of kind of the geek empire, but, you know, I'm much more rooted in tabletop gaming, and horror and, comedy kind of subgenre stuff. While I definitely enjoy science fiction and fantasy, Cameron is kind of in different sections of that, but it's actually really nice because,
isn't it?
It is. It really is. I actually really enjoy it because I get to see stuff that I never would have even noticed previously.
Totally. Absolutely.
And I love cons. So going to cons with Cameron is fantastic. And again, you know, I get to see things. I get to meet a bunch of people who I never would have met otherwise. And I get to, you know, I don't know, maybe run a D&D game for a bunch of people at a con for some reason that I never would have met otherwise. So it's a good time.
No, I completely agree. It's a ton of fun. Because Mike and I are showing each other stuff all the time. And my biggest thing in a relationship is you need to be constantly mentally stimulated by the other person. And if sharing books and comic books and TV shows and movies with someone else isn't mentally stimulating, then I don't know what is.
Full disclosure. My wife thinks that all things geek are, you know, on par with communism. you know, we just have like a very different worldview. You know, I do the geek stuff on my own, and she's real into fashion and like that. Our worlds don't intersect very much. So for me, it's like when I have something that I need to do, like record this podcast or, work on, you know, an essay that I'm working on or editing a piece of a fiction that I'm working on. My wife is largely sort of like mad at me. Not mad at me, but she's sort of like, you know, that's definitely time away from the family. But so when I imagine when Cameron is crashing on a deadline or Mike is crashing on a deadline, I mean, that's, it's a different for you all, I assume. I mean, you're very much bought into this. This is their career. But what do you do during deadline time? I mean, how do you handle that when Mike or Cameron check out for, you know, a week?
Well, mostly I just kind of, in the back of my head, I monitor to make sure she's eating, once in a while.
Oh, no.
Because she normally it's not a problem, but you know, you get writing and you lock yourself in the room and you lose track of time. But mostly, honestly, I just try and like keep everything out of her way because I am invested. You know, it's like this is her thing, and not only is it her thing, it's her it's her thing that she does in addition to another day job. So you know, she has puts a lot of energy toward this. So it's like she cares about it. I care about her. So it's mostly just, hey, you know, make sure everything goes well. And plus, you know, like I said, I'm into games. So I just call up my friends and I'm like, hey, you want a game? And you know, if I'm bored, it's okay. You know, I can find something to do.
Jason, you can admit it. Do you kind of look forward to deadline time because you get like 72 hours of gaming time?
She won't even know. If I could probably leave for like 2 or 3 days and she wouldn't even know I was gone. I certainly enjoy gaming, but it's just one of the things that comes with the profession.
Mike and I's relationship was sort of founded on the understanding that we are both workaholic insomniacs. So, I mean, Mike has this day. I work all the time, and Mike has, on top of the Coast Guard and the writing, also works his day job at the NYPD. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. Yeah, he says that stuff. He works at the OMAD. There's been a lot of times when Mike is, you know, working really, really late working on something, but then there'll be nights where I've been working on a script for 16 hours that day. So there's a lot of empathy and there's a lot of mutual support that goes on. And if one of us is really busy, the other one will clean and take care of dinner and vice versa. So we just sort of, and we don't have kids. And so, you know, our careers are our life. So there's a lot of just mutual, like, oh, okay, tonight's a crazy night for you. I'll take care of this. Oh, tonight's a crazy night for you. I'll take care of this. And yeah. when he is really, really cranking, I make sure that he comes home. The whole apartment is clean. Dinner's on the table. All he needs to do is to eat and sit down and write. And I think the most important thing that – and I think this is not just for writers. This is for anyone who has an all-consuming job and or a separate passion that – they spend a lot of time on, is that I try to make sure that Mike doesn't think that I'm resenting him. I try not to lay in bed and go, oh, honey, why aren't you coming to bed? Oh, why are you working so much? Because I know how important it is to him. And I know that his writing is one of the most important things in his life. And like just my movie career is one of the most important things in my life. So the best thing you can do is just shut the fuck up and not complain and not, this is the person that you chose and this is the life that you chose with them. And the best thing you can do is just support them.
Yeah. I like that. I'm going to play that back to my wife and then run.
Just have it on.
Well, everyone, and like I said, it's not just for writers. I think a lot of relationships, everyone has to have something they're into, you know, and it doesn't matter if fashion's what she's into, then that's fucking awesome. As long as you respect her, what she's into, and she respects what you're into, they don't have to be the same thing. I mean, I'm all about Mike and I's serious nerd love, but it works in all kinds of relationships.
Yeah, that's very true. That's the thing. Like you said the topic was about writers, I'm like, a lot of the relationship stuff with writers, you can apply very broadly. Just to anybody who has a job that takes them away a lot or makes them need to be, you know, get a little alone time with the computer or whatever.
Mike and I's first date was when I was out in LA shooting Kids vs. Monsters. He flew almost 3,000 miles to go on a first date with me, and then we didn't see each other for another month and a half. That sucks. Like, that's the shit you have to deal with when you're with someone who works all the time.
I kind of have to imagine that the fact that you're both intensely creative people as well, sort of aids in the whole, understanding and coping with somebody else expressing themselves in that way. Because that's, at the end of the day, writing, it's you're creating something and the process of creation yields no results in and of itself. You know, there's no instant gratification. I mean, it's this long protracted period. And I think that being involved with somebody who is equally creative in their own way, really aids in the understanding of that dynamic. It has to be difficult for people that are in relationships where, you know, like, you always hear about the people who, like, I never wrote a novel until my kids went away to college. You know, and it's like, all of a sudden you've had this relationship with this marriage and you send your kids to college and you're like, I'm going to write a novel. It's like, all of a sudden your life just changes and you're and you're going deep into this. And I just think that it's interesting that you both sort of have founded your relationships beginning on the fact that, like, this is our life. This is what we do. Is that true for you too, Jason? That, I mean, you and Cameron have been together for a long time. Has she always been a writer?
Yes. Yeah, well, she's been a writer for a really long time, apparently. I saw some boxes of stuff she was writing when she was a kid, apparently.
Super awesome.
Yeah, her mom sent her all these boxes of stuff that she...
What's going to the archive, right?
Yeah, it is. It's all
nice.
Going to the archive.
Those things are going to be worth a lot of money someday.
I know. I tried to get
your retirement sitting right there in those boxes. Yeah.
But I mean, she's been a writer ever since we got together. I mean, since before we got together. So, I mean, it was one of those things where I understood going in. I was like, okay, she has a day job and she writes. You know, there's going to be a lot of time where she's going to have to be engaged with that stuff. And, you know, and I'm okay with that because I have electronic, amusement, and I have tabletop games to plot, and I have other stuff I work on. So, I mean, you know, we have fun together when we can have fun together, and it does. I think I'd like to think it helps that I'm kind of a creative person and that I have spent some time alone working on my own stuff. And so I have some empathy there, but you know, I don't know that you necessarily need that. You just have to have that empathy to understand, hey, this person has a thing they're passionate about, and try to understand that they need to put energy toward that.
I think it has a lot to do with values as well. Like for me, creativity I don't write books and I'm not really involved with books at all, but books are extraordinarily important to me. I am a huge, huge reader, and that aspect of life is so important to me, and it's so important to him. So much of our relationship is founded on this mutual love of stories and this mutual love of art. And it's really become a huge, huge part of what our relationship is. And I think that can be unique in creative relationships. I mean, we don't create together, which some artists, couples do, but it's something that we both place a lot of emphasis on in our life. And you know, it's just something that we constantly talk about, and on our days off, we like to go to a bookstore and we like to read comics together and read books together and talk. And so it's just something that we're really, really into together. And I feel like it really strengthens our relationship.
So yeah, it's adorable. It's adorbs.
We're disgusting.
I feel like what y'all are kicking down to me here, and you always hear about, people always ask this question. I see this question pop up all the time. Like, I saw Mary Robinette Kowal answer it one time on Writing Excuses, and I see it come up in other places, you know, like, how do I get my spouse to understand that I'm going to spend all this time writing, and how do you deal with it? And so it sounds to me like what y'all are kicking down here.
To get a good spouse?
Well, yeah,
that helps.
Right? A fucking man, dude.
But it sounds like what you're kicking down here is that at the end of the day, the point is that, like, existing with a writer is just existing. It's like existing with any other profession. I mean, I feel like if you're going to struggle with your significant other being a writer, you're going to struggle with your significant other being doing anything that is consuming. Mm-hmm. And that maybe there isn't, there certainly doesn't seem to be some mystical, you know, happy place people can go.
I can understand where some couples, like, I mean, to be completely harsh, like, Mike is a professional writer, just like Cameron is a professional writer. Mike makes money, makes a living off of writing. He is a pro. It's not as if he's spending, you know, half of his life on something that isn't supporting him. So I feel like me and Jason probably have it a little easier than someone who is married to or dating or in some sort of relationship with someone who hasn't made it pro yet, just because there isn't that proof. Like, hey, see, look at, I spent all this time, but look at it. I'm actually professional now. So I could see where that would be a little difficult. For me, I feel like it's pretty easy. It's a job like it's any other job. I'm staring at this giant wall of Mike Cole's Shadow Ops novels to prove it.
Mike Cole has a whole wall of Shadow Ops novels. That's what I would do too. If I published a book too, I would just have a whole wall that was just Shadow Ops books. I
mean, wall-sized posters, basically.
I mean, yeah, he's got all the. he's got all the all his novels and all the different versions and all the different languages and like some of the anthologies he's been in and stuff. And I feel kind of weird when I dust them when he's not here. I'm like, ooh, Michael.
The alarm doesn't go off because they've been touched, does
he? He hasn't signed them himself, has he?
No.
To Mike, this is a great book.
To myself, this is a great book. The
Keep
author
the
is very
work.
Sexy. Love. Yeah. But no, I can understand. I mean, if it would be different if Mike was spending all of his time making like macaroni sculptures that he didn't do anything with. But this is his job. This is what he gets paid to do. This is his. He's just extraordinarily lucky in the way that things that he gets paid to do is what he loves and his dream. So that, and I can definitely see where it would require some more patience.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I mean, obviously, we know that the vast majority of people who are writing and trying to be published are not published and are dealing with these questions when there is no demonstrable proof that it's working. And I think that is certainly an uphill challenge. And, you know, I know Jason, certainly when, you know, Cameron has had her travails with publishing, and her publishers. And I'm sure that as you see her going through that, like that becomes a challenge. And because it puts so much stress on her that these things are not going the way they should be going or that you would like them to go. And I can only imagine how much more challenging that would be for somebody who can't even get across the line.
It would have to definitely be hard for them and hard for anybody they're in a relationship with, because like Mallory says, it's easy when you go, I do this and then I get money for it, or I get money to do this. Whereas, you know, when there are publishing issues or when the money isn't a sure thing, when you're just trying to break out, it would have to be rough.
Yeah, that's so stressful. And I'm sure you've had to deal with that. It requires an even greater level of support and love and care and patience. To be like, all right, this is what you love. Well, I'm cool with that. I will be there for you.
Yeah. But again, just with any relationship, you know, it's just a, you know, how supportive are you of your spouse, and how can you help them out? And just like anything else, you know, hopefully you can do what you need to do to help them do what they need to do.
All right. So Jason, have you read all of Cameron's books?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would hope you have. I know her mom hasn't read all her books.
I have
to
say yes, because she's going to listen to this, and otherwise I'll be in trouble.
Right. So in her second book, Infidel, there is a scene in which I will never forget. It is one of the most gruesome scenes I have ever read. And it's the scene where when children die. And it's awful.
The well scene.
It's like a scene that if you've read that book, that scene is indelibly imprinted on your mind. Do you read that and you're like, I go to bed at night with the person that came up with that?
Well, like I did mention that I enjoy horror, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. You have to understand that as a spouse, one of my duties is when she comes to me and I'm like reading through something before, you know, it goes out or whatever, which, you know, she puts through several like edits or rounds before I even get to see it. And I go, you know, this is bad, but you should make this worse. Because this isn't bad enough.
Hell
so,
yeah.
So that's like where I come from. So I don't really have a problem with that, but then again, I don't have a problem with a lot of traditionally disturbing things. So
there you go. Shared psychosis are the best psychosis.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Mal, a little twist on that question to you. I consider Mike a very good friend of mine, and I have read all of his works. And I've read all of his books multiple times, except the first one. And I see a lot of elements of his life and of his relationships reflected in his books. And so this is like, this happens, right? Like we all know this happens, but as somebody who is close to him, or to a writer, How do you deal with seeing elements of your own interactions in his work? I mean, things that are from your relationship or things that you've gone through that may not always be pleasant and maybe challenges that you've had that are now reflected in the fiction. Is that weird?
I mean, it was funny you say that because there's a lot now in the latest version of Fractured Girl, there's a lot of my influence in there. And even, in Javelin Rain, the one that he's writing right now, he constantly is telling me that he puts all these little turns of phrases in there because of me and all this stuff. But it's, it doesn't bother me. I think it's kind of cool. And I think Mike and I are attached at the hip, and you cannot be that close with someone without them affecting what you're creating in some form. And let's face it, and not when you dedicate your life to someone and spend all your life with someone, it's not all positive. And if you were gonna deny that, then you're denying a gigantic fact of a relationship, and it's silly. And I'm okay with that. It's not like Mike, you know, takes fights that we have and puts it on Twitter or anything. And I'm just happy that he cares enough about me that I'm affecting his art. I think that's really powerful and really awesome.
That is pretty awesome. Jason, have you ever seen anything in one of Cameron's books where you're like, really? You're going to pull that one out?
No, not at all. Cameron does a really good job of filtering everything to the point where I don't think most people would recognize it as something.
Yeah.
Except for God's War with sneakers. Except for that the sneakers scene. But other than that.
You know what's really, really funny is Mike wrote Gemini, his latest that's coming out next month, Gemini Cell, before he met me. But the protagonist, who is slightly reminiscent of Mike, his main love interest has like bright dyed hair and is covered in tattoos, which is what I look like. And when I met Mike, he told me, like, he's like, that's my dream girl, is you. You know, this girl is got bright colored hair and is covered in tattoos, and it's really creepy. Now, because I'm reading Gemini Cell right now, I'm just like, oh god, this is very bizarre. Are you sure you didn't stalk me and then try to ask me out?
It's a good pickup line. Like, look, you might be, I can prove it. It's in
I can prove it with this published novel.
You look like my protagonist.
That's something that horrible happens too.
Gets him every time.
Yeah, no, I actually got that phone call from Mike Mao, which was like, dude, you've read Gemini Cell. Like, I met her. that was pretty much what that conversation was like.
Yeah, that's pretty weird. Life imitates art. There you go.
So we've established that being in a relationship with a writer is perhaps not that not as challenging as others might make it seem, or it's no more challenging.
Just say that to scare people away from the writers, so we can have them all.
Yeah, that's true.
Or writers say it to scare off the competition. That could be the other thing that happens. But y'all are both into horror, which I think is kind of cool. When we were kind of chatting beforehand, Mallory was listing off some of the films that her production company has done, and Jason, you actually seem familiar with them.
Yes, Lord of Tears.
Which is cool. So Mal, like, tell me a little bit about, like, I mean, you work in film. That's quite a bit different than literature.
It is.
Give me a little insight. So when you say you work in film, like, what are you doing on a daily basis? I mean, where do you work in Brooklyn? I presume you live in Brooklyn. I presume production isn't in Brooklyn. So you're working from home a lot?
Yes. I am my own office. And from day to day, every day of the year, I'm the communications director for the company. So I run all the social media. I run all the websites. Like, if you email Dark Dunes, you get me. But also for our individual projects, I produce them. And so when we go to shoot or we do an event, I fly out to wherever in the world we are and I do the event, or I work on the film and I produce. And so, just making producers, just sort of like a organizer, manager, depending on what type of producer you are. But the type of producing I do, organizing and managing a project. And that's what I do.
And so you're going to like the film festivals and stuff. Yeah.
We do a little bit of film fests. We actually sponsor the Bram Stoker Film Festival over in England. But we do a lot of cons, and we do, Yeah, just stuff like that. Sort of the sort of equivalent of in the literary world of cons, but for film.
So Jason, from the consumer standpoint, indie horror, or horror in general is, I mean, when you say horror, like, you're kind of talking about indie horror, at least it seems like. I mean, there is some big production horror, but
mainstream horror is usually not real horror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not very good.
I'll just put that out there.
Well, it's like when I met, C. Robert Cargill, who wrote Sinister.
Oh, I love Cargill!
Yeah, that dude's crazy.
He's a peach.
His wife
is a peach too.
Yeah, his wife's lovely. We could add her on here too. I'm sure she'd have some thoughts about living with a crazy writer.
Oh, I'm sure.
When I met Cargill, he said, "Oh yeah, I wrote a film called Sinister." And the way he said it was like, you know, I should definitely know what this film is. And I had no idea what Sinister was. And I just think it's because this horror film thing is huge. Like, there's a huge audience for these films, but, you know, they're not getting wide theatrical release, but they're there.
Yes.
And so from a consumer standpoint, Jason, like, how do you even find this stuff? Like, is there like, where is this subculture going on? I don't know.
Well, there's this thing called the internet.
Are you shitting me?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I mean, there are a lot of websites that are devoted to finding this out that are basically journalism for the horror genre, specifically because of the reasons that you said. Basically, it's like, how do I get this information? How do I find this stuff out? And of course, a lot of people take it into their own hands and don't leave it to the journal. You know, there's websites, the one that comes to mind immediately is, bloodydisgusting.com, I think is fairly
Red
big.
Is Fangoria.
Yep. Fangoria.
Shock Till You Drop.
Yeah. But, like Lord of Tears is a perfect example. A lot of people don't leave that stuff to those. They, especially now, are doing a lot of that guerrilla marketing and stuff like that, where they, you know, they put cool, crazy videos out there, or they're like, hey, look, we're in this abandoned hospital and everything is fine.
We just did another one.
Did you? Oh my gosh, I'll have to check it out. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the Lord of Tears is this gigantic owl dude with these giant claw hands, basically, in a suit.
Like a business suit?
He's like Slenderman, but an owl.
He is. He's like Slenderman, but with a giant creepy owl head and giant creepy owl claws for hands. And so imagine that for some reason, you're in an abandoned hospital and you see this guy. You're probably gonna need a new pair of pants. And it's that sort of thing. I don't know. The internet is full of horror stuff. If you're interested, you can find it. I think the problem
just like sci-fi fantasy stuff.
Yeah. The problem that I think any genre has is how do I break out of everybody who already loves my genre and get other people to find out about me so that they will so that it can grow beyond that. And you know, the answer is marketing and crossing your fingers. Yes.
No, that is exactly it. It's the genre gutter. Like, I mean, Mirror Empire made a huge splash in the sci-fi fantasy community this year. It was a huge, 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 huge deal. But the crushing part is that if you just, like a regular, someone who's just inter lit, say, oh, hey, have you ever heard of Cameron Hurley? They're like, who? Same thing with films. And I mean all the respect in the world to Cameron, but it's like, that's the killer thing about genre. And then they find, oh, it's science fiction. Oh, it's horror. And then, I mean, we could talk about the genre gutter to war blue in the face. Everybody's talked about it, but it's very, very frustrating. And it's across all mediums, not just books.
Yeah. And I think that's almost why it's so important to use vacation time to go to cons and try and get to those people who are maybe on the edges of those genres that maybe they spread word and of course with Cameron, she's been blogging for such a long time that of course the blog, oh, sorry, I don't mean to hurt you there, Justin. I know it probably is still a little sore.
Stings.
Yeah. We miss it. But the blog helped her out too, because the blog wasn't just for it. That wasn't really a sci-fi fantasy, you know, sci-fi, fantasy blog. It was, you know, for, you know, feminism and for other stuff. So That I think helped her fan base out a little bit, I guess. But again, you know, it's the how many lines can I get outside of my genre to pull people toward this thing? You know, Stephen King, you know, isn't you know, you say Stephen King and everybody knows who Stephen King is now.
But he's a horror writer. It makes me so bad.
Exactly. But he's a horror writer. But, you know, Stephen King puts a book out and no matter how bad it is, it's going to sell because it's Stephen King. So,
yeah, what's interesting is I wrote a panel description for Worldcon this last year that was postulating horror in writing, which is sort of like, how as a horror writer do you find any air in the room when there are basically four horror writers, maybe five? You know, it's like Stephen King, Joe Hill, Anne Rice, and the other guy.
Dean Koontz.
No, it's like, isn't it like, it's Craven or whatever. There's another guy.
Craven Peter the Straub? Hunter? Are you talking about Spider-Man villains?
No, it's like, is it Clive Cussler? No, it's not Clive Cussler. It's
Clive Barker.
Clive Barker. Thank you.
Oh, I love Clive Barker so much.
And Clive Barker. But, so there's like these just a small handful of writers that when they put a book out, right, it sells like millions of copies, but everybody else is like just barely struggling to make it. Robert Jackson Bennett was somebody that I cited as being kind of a modern horror writer, although he's more in fantasy now, but his previous stuff was very horror oriented, but like, nobody really knew how to like get him to Stephen King's audience, which is like the eternal question. And what's bizarre is that, and you look at film, like science fiction and fantasy and film is now like out of the genre gutter, sort of. I mean, it's making money, like boatloads of money. And yet horror film, maybe not so much, but when you look at writing, you know, the cream of the crop horror is crushing, you know, Stephen King, Joe Hill, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a few science fiction writers that get up into there and fantasy writers that get up into there, but not really. Not really.
Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, I mean, Neil's mainstream. I think he's more mainstream. I mean, he's kind of like we like to claim him as our own, but, you know.
Come back to us,
Neil. He has moved beyond us.
Yeah, like, I don't know if Neil ever really wrote, like, pure, you know, geeky shit. You know, I mean, it's geeky, but it's not like, you know, anyway, that's semantics. But, but we don't have, you know, we have Weeks and we have Sanderson and they do well, right? They do very well. They hit number one on the list. But if you look at total sales sold, I mean, it's not Stephen King number one. You know what I mean? It's a big difference. And so it's strange to me that exists. Anyway.
Well, it's funny that, cause Mike and I actually have this conversation all the time, cause Mike's novels are military fantasy. So he is immediately put into the military gutter. So people think, oh, I don't like military stuff. I'm not going to read your books.
And the stuff he writes is so different from the standard military, like, especially the standard military sci-fi or military fantasy stuff that people think of. It's like so night and day from what he writes.
Oh, absolutely. But so we have this is something that we bond over all the time. Because I have this moment all the time at cons. People are like, oh, you're Michael's girlfriend. So what do you do? Oh, I make horror films. Oh. Horror, huh? There's such a stigma. So when people hear that Mike writes military books, they completely disregard the fantasy thing and they just think that he writes, you know, like SEAL Team 666, Clive Cussler stuff. And when they think that I make horror films, they think, oh, I'm making a slasher movie with gratuitous tits and blood everywhere. There's such a stigma for the genre that they don't think that the thought that it could be just a good story never crosses anyone's mind. But that's in all genres across every. So, and it's so, but the problem is with the marketing is how are you going to reach these fans? It's tough.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a thing to blame here. Like, should we be looking at, you know, Terry Goodkind 90s fantasy and being like, God damn it, you ruined it for a generation. And then should we be looking at like, you know, Jason versus Freddy and being like, God damn it, you ruined it for a generation. I mean, I do think in some ways there's, like we have really long memories, you know, and bad horror of the 80s is that is what I think of as a horror film because that's what I grew up watching and they sucked. We may have some nostalgia for them, but they're terrible films. In much the same way that like David Eddings and Terry Brooks, those, I have great nostalgia. Dragonlance, God, Dragonlance. I mean, I have great nostalgia.
Bringing it back.
But I have great nostalgia for those books. I love them, but they're awful.
They're awful. They're awful.
You're talking to the woman who has Drizzt Do'Urd and Scimitar tattooed on her chest, okay? I hear you.
Jason's like, totally we have got to hang out.
Ari Salvatore is my step uncle, actually.
Is that nice. True? Is that true? Bob's your step?
That's absolutely true.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
Bob's your uncle.
My dad married his niece.
So.
Pretty weird.
That's awesome. But, but we have like really long memories and these things are indelibly seared on us. You know, it's like we can't change our perspective on what we think of these things. And,
First impression syndrome.
It affects how we buy things. Robert Jackson Bennett actually did a really amazing blog post this year about genre. And it's so hard because it's something that we need as a group of consumers to break out of. And we just need to find good stories. But that's never how people are going to shop for things. And I do it. Like I walk into Barnes & Noble because I am lucky enough to live in New York City. And I there's the one last Barnes & Noble in the world that has a horror section. And that's where I go first because that's the shit I like. And like, it's harder to sell me on a story or a book that isn't in my wheelhouse. It's hard
as a consumer too, especially with the way that like there's so much stuff vying for our attention now that you almost need those boxes just to help you know where to look. But at the same time, you know, Cameron is constantly furious that she has to say this is fantasy or this is sci-fi. Like you were stumbling over it earlier, Justin, because she just like it's a book. She's like, yeah. It's a book and it's about this and that's what it is. But of course, you know, it's impossible to dodge that genre.
When Mike and I first started dating, and so I bought Control Point in secret. And this was good because I was out in LA at the time, so he didn't know. Because I was so worried about me not liking it, so I wanted to read it first just to make sure. And I love Mike's books unabashedly. I know that I have a huge bias, so no one will believe me, but I love Mike's writing. But I totally will admit, I was like, military? I don't know. But I just – these monikers and these, like these little boxes, when a story is good, a story is good. It doesn't matter what the trappings are, but it's so hard to keep that in your mind all the time and conscientiously think like that when you're buying literature and films and games and comics and all that stuff. It's hard.
I'm just going to do a little segue. It's what we call a segue in the biz.
A segue.
Segue. Yeah. We talk about this idea of like me having ingrained thoughts about genre and about boxes and about how we think of things and categorize things. And I, as you mentioned, Jason, Jared Sheeran of Porno Kitsch and I had like an hour and a half conversation once about whether God's War was science fiction or fantasy. I'm like, that was like a dead serious. We are such geeks, but that was like a dead serious conversation.
I can tell you.
No, I don't want to know.
The final word.
I don't want to know.
It's a vampire romance novel.
Yeah, it's actually secretly vampire romance. But, with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Secretly.
Dinosaurs that you cut off their heads because that's...
Well, yeah. You have to. Absolutely.
But another great example of this, and this is something that, that I'm endlessly fascinated by about, is like gaming. And either video games, this has already happened for video games, where video games went from being dork central to being like, if you don't play video games, at least at some level, like you're just not with the times. But I think we're also seeing it with other types of gaming, and I know, Jason, you're a big tabletop gaming guy, and things like Dungeons & Dragons, which 10 years ago or even 15 years ago or certainly 20 years ago was like, you know, weird and spooky and creepy. I remember my mom told me that, you know, God forbid that I play Dungeons & Dragons and slowly become satanic and, you know, murder them in their sleep.
Hail Satan.
Yeah, right, of course. But today, you know, it's almost like I need to get my kids involved in some Dungeons and Dragons. That's good, clean fun.
I know, it is, right? It's so funny. Like literally when I was growing up, when I was gaming, my first impression of D&D was a lot stranger than a lot of people's because my grandfather basically was like, I'm running you on some first edition stuff. When I was like super young. Because, and he did that for his kids too. He's like, this is fun. This is, you know, fun stuff. So I grew up with that. Yeah, he was awesome. So I grew up with this very positive impression of tabletop gaming, that it was the perfect way to socially exist with people. Especially if you're kind of a dork, it's the perfect buffer to say, there's this thing that's taking just enough of my attention that I'm not self-conscious. So I can talk to other people who may be in that exact same boat. But yeah, when I was growing up as a teenager, they were still writing articles about Satanists and the steam tunnels and all that stuff. And now it's very, very different. It's become so, it's whipped around so fast with just so many people being comfortable with fantasy, I think in general, through various means with, I don't know, I have to throw World of Warcraft out there just because so many people play it. But it brought,
I think that probably did a huge, huge, help for the fantasy gaming community.
Oh, yeah,
normalizing absolutely.
Totally. Cause it's just like so many people play WoW that it kind of brought fantasy out there and said, hey, this isn't that weird. Look how many people are doing it.
Oh, dude, at the auction house.
I got to tell you guys a story about this. I'm going to interrupt everything to tell the World of Warcraft story. It's fantastic. It's a great story.
Dude, I'm all about it.
So I spent basically from age 22 to 25, I played World of Warcraft. I also had a job. But I played World of Warcraft, and it was a little extreme. You know, like I was a tank, a 40-man raid tank, and you know, the whole
what night. Were you? So just let me know. What were you?
I was a gnome warrior.
Go okay. Gnomes.
Yeah, I was a gnome warrior. Pink hair.
Dwarf priestess, holy spec right here.
All right. Yeah, no, I was sword and
gnomish
board.
Rogue.
Well, we almost have a five-man here.
I was by faction, though, because I also had a Torrent Druid.
Okay.
Yeah, I also played. I swing
both ways.
Yeah, yeah. I tried out the Torrent, and I had to give the undead a shot.
Everyone gets a little undead curious.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm big into it, right? I'm big into it. And I meet my wife. And my wife is not into nerds at all. And she thought I was a jock, which I am, but I'm also a nerd. And so, you know, we date.
I think that's why you and Mike are really good friends.
Yeah, Mike and I get along great.
You do have that nerd jock, like, fusion thing.
And we're dating, and, you know, my wife comes from a very traditional background. She's first generation American. Her parents are from Colombia. She lived with her parents until we got married. She never spent the night, you know, very traditional. So, you know, I'd drop her off at home every night at about 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And then I'd go home and I'd game until, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. Like, that's what we do, right?
Yes, you do.
And so, and then we got married.
Oh, shit.
And we went on our honeymoon. And we
dropped her off at home.
And she knew. Yeah. Right. and she knew that I game. She did know. But she, I don't think she really knew. And yeah. So after we get back from our honeymoon, it's the first night back, and I wasn't really planning to play, but a friend of mine called me and said, "Hey man, I can't tank the raid tonight. Can you do it?" And I'm like, "Yeah. Totes." So, you know, I log in, I get my headset on, you know, cuz of course, you know, we're using I don't know what the hell we were using, TeamSpeak or one of the other.
TeamSpeak, yeah. Probably back then, yeah.
And this was in the late 2006, 2007. And so I get on and I start running the raid. And my wife's sleeping. We're in a one-bedroom condo. And I'm tanking a raid. And you know, when you're leading a raid, like, you know, you're calling heals, you're calling, you know. You know,
you can't be quiet.
No, in, out, you know, you know, reposition, turn him, and all this stuff. And I'm shouting. And she doesn't say a word all night. The next morning, she wakes up and she looks at me and she says, "Justin, I love you." This is the best. That's the best way to start any conversation. "Justin, I love you and I appreciate that you're really into this and I'm fine with you playing video games, but you, if you ever tank a raid while I'm trying to sleep again, this marriage may not last very long. And
that's
so
an amazing, adorable story.
I actually closed my WoW account that week and never played again.
Wow, that's some fucking love right there, dude.
Wow.
I did. Shoot. I gave it up. And I got so much more productive. It worked because I stopped theory crafting at work. Yeah. You know, they had like the WoW armory where you could like test the different equipment on your stats.
Dude, I remember that shit, man.
And as soon as that went away, my productivity went way up. It was great.
Yep. Yeah, I took me 3 tries to quit. Finally, sometimes I still yearn for it, you know, especially in the wintertime.
Dude, I crave it. I miss gaming, but with, you know, with kids and like real life, it's so antisocial to the people in your life. Because it's so all consuming. You know, the headset
up until they get to the point where we can slap a little VR helmet on the kids and they can participate, so they can be there with you,
right,
in the game. And you know,
but this, you know, this speaks back to something else we talked about, which is, you know, like being into the same shit your spouse is into. You know, I'm really blessed that my wife and I don't always have the same interests, so she pulls me out of it, you know. And I think there's something to be said for that, you know. And Mal, you and Mike probably don't overlap enough that you pull each other into each other's stuff.
Yes. Like because after I quit, wow, I used to be really, really big into MMORPGs, and I quit, and I haven't really gamed since. Like once in a great while, I mean, I moved from New England, so I'm not around my friends anymore. But if someone like I played Borderlands 2 on like a friend's console, but I don't have consoles. I don't play on my computers anymore. Mike does. Mike's a big iPad gamer, which is better for him because it takes less time and he can do it for like 20 minutes, half an hour before bed. But I don't game anymore. So it's, you know, if he's sitting there still playing after an hour in bed, I can kind of be like, hey, I'm naked. You want to not do that? And it's good for him. At least I think. But no, I completely agree. Sometimes I think it's good. I forget who I was talking about this with recently, but Lauren Panapinto, who is the art director for Orbit. I was talking about this with her last night. It's good to have like a spouse that you have like a 70 to 80% compatibility rate with, to have just enough at least to pull someone out and have some differences so you can show each other stuff and so you don't get completely consumed. It's nice and healthy. Yeah. Living with writers is fun.
It is. It's fun.
Go kiss a writer tonight, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, go find one and yeah, do that.
Make up with them. Because they're great.
I have no further comment. I have no further comment. Thank you both. This has been Rocket Talk.